Trib Live Radio presents Off-Road Politics from Main Street to the Beltway with Selena Zito, reporter at the Pittsburgh Trib, and Dr. Laura Brown, a professor at George Washington University. Trib Total Media, see what's next. Now, here's your host, Selena Zito.
Hi, this is Selena Zito, reporter and columnist at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to Off-Road Politics, where we connect Main Street with Washington, D.C., and all the shenanigans that are going on there, and for the and with the people that we are covering who want to be leaders in that capital city. On the line with me is my partner in crime, Dr. Laura Brown, George Washington University. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be on.
Nice to have you on. And we have a special guest today. It's Allison Dagnes. She is a professor of political science at Shippingburg University. So it's somewhere halfway between Pittsburgh and Washington, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Right. Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for having for joining us. We got a lot to talk about this week. I want the two topics I really want to cover are what we saw in the debate on Wednesday night was it Boulder, Colorado? Were they in Boulder?
Yep, they were in Boulder. Yep.
Between the Republican rivals, and then I want to talk a little bit about John Boehner and Paul Ryan. And Laura, I really want to talk about what you wrote the other day about the makeup of the House, and how fractured, or it isn't fractured, maybe it isn't fractured. I'd like to address that too. But the first thing let's hit is the CNBC debate. It was a challenging, sometimes contemptuous format, but I think that the best debaters rose to the top. This is what the debate process is for. You willow away the weaker candidates. You find out what candidates what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. I think the biggest blow in the debates came in the form of counterpunches. Marco Rubio delivered a perfectly timed and executed shot to Jeb Bush, his former mentor, and he was pretty much strong all night. What are your thoughts?
I agree with you. I think that certainly we're not going to be the first to say that Jeb had a lot at stake in this debate, and he did not rise to the occasion, which is really unfortunate. And I got to say, very surprising. I mean, going into all of this, he was my easy pick because I thought that all of the innovative fundraising that he did with the Super PAC and the 501Cs, I thought this was the sign of the future of campaigning from a guy who had his arms around what it took to run for president. And I am gobsmacked that he has done so badly, because going into this thing, I thought, it's Jeb! In a walk, and it's not.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, Laura. What do you think? I mean, I almost felt bad for him, not just on the personal level to see someone that he, considered a friend, go at him, but just to see how it's almost as if time has passed him by, and.
I mean, I was going to say I absolutely agree with you that time has passed him by. I don't think that he is where the Republican Party is. I think that if you look at kind of all of the Bushes together, right, the first Bush raised taxes when he said he wouldn't. George W. Bush became a big government conservative, which is really what initiated and angered those people who later formed the Tea Party.
Right.
And now, you have Jeb saying, look, I'll rescue this. But the conservative, small government, folks within the party just don't believe that the Bushes are a conservative family. And I think what they're saying is, we don't want anything to do with him.
Can I ask Laura a question real quick? Because I agree with you, but how much, and I'm genuinely asking this, and this is not a pushback at all, how much of the Republican Party writ large now is that conservative wing who feels so strongly, and how much are establishment Republicans who feel that another Bush would actually be not a bad thing? What's your sense?
Well, I mean,
I don't know, I have my arms around that.
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you, I literally think the party is pretty much split down the middle.
Okay.
I think what you are seeing when you look kind of at the overall composition of the Republican Party is that, well, ideologically, they agree on a lot of things. There are a couple sort of issues where there really is kind of a distinct 50-50 split, and immigration happens to be one of them. You know, where 49% of Republicans, according to some Pew Research, kind of want, you know, a more stringent approach to immigration, whereas 51%, you know, are interested in essentially reforming immigration and bringing about kind of a different, more economic reality around it that a lot of the establishment Republicans look at. So, I mean, I think part of what we're seeing is, in fact, this real divide within the party about who they are, what their identity is, and really what do they want to represent from a platform standpoint.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I think going into this debate, you saw conservative and Republican regulars looking to find a candidate to unite behind and play sort of David to the seemingly Goliath of Trump and Carson and their populist passion. And I think Rubio gave them a glimpse of that. But I think also at the grassroots level, we are going to learn between now and 10 days from now, when you have the next debate, that Ted Cruz also had a great night. He connected on issues, and he had that sort of I call it the Newt Gingrich moment, where Gingrich in 2012 at the primary in South Carolina went after the media in a very effective and passionate way.
Right.
There were a lot of very conservative people in that audience. I happened to be at that debate, and he was able to win the moment. Now, he did not go in and win the obviously did not win the nomination, but he did take advantage of that moment and those sentiments, and was able to win the South Carolina primary, taking away the Palmetto State sort of line of always picking whoever ended up being the nominee by winning that primary. What do you guys think about Cruz? Allie?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think Cruz's shot against the media was particularly effective because in this specific case, the media was terrible.
It was terrible.
Those
oh
questions
my God.
Were awful. So, I mean, so he, you know, it was the first, you know, strike across the bow, and it landed really effectively because even, you know, Democrats were going, oh, yeah, this is bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
this is no good. So when you are speaking a truth that everybody can kind of nod along and agree with, I think you're going to be effective there. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about, wasn't he the president of the Harvard Debate Club? I mean, you know, he's really articulate, and that was very clear, and he was able to answer the questions he wanted to answer in the way that he wanted to answer them. So he had a clear mastery of the stage. I think that had Rubio not done so well, it probably would have been Cruz's sort of big night to shine. And I think that, you know, I think that very conservative Republicans who are watching carefully note how clear and articulate Cruz is as opposed to Carson, and that may be making them scratch the back of their heads about Carson, because I thought that he was not very clear. I mean, I thought he did not really make any points that landed effectively.
Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Allie. I do think that many conservatives are asking themselves, is this the person that we want to sort of represent the evangelical wing of the party, you know, that side that did support Huckabee, that supported Santorum, and, in fact, in later stages last time around, also supported Newt Gingrich. So I think what you're really seeing is, again, kind of these larger fights that are taking place almost through the candidates, even though, you know, they're really, I think, passionately believing in the things that they're saying, they are also representing a much larger dynamic. And I think, you know, Cruz did well, and so did Rubio, but I don't think that we can get away from Fiorina.
Right, Fiorina, exactly.
You talked about this. right after the debate, she was kind of pitch perfect in every one of her answers, and she managed to take up the majority of the time.
I mean, right.
Had the most time in the debate. And yet, oddly enough, she isn't being talked about in kind of this aftermath the way that Rubio or Cruz are.
Right. And I'm not quite sure why that is happening, but she was very strong. She had a very good tone, and she presented herself well. She was very calm. A lot of them got more excited and sometimes irritated, but she always maintained this sort of grace that you don't always see on the debate stage.
No, that's true. I would think, and maybe I'm wrong here, that these debates lead to these moments of oh, as I like to call them.
Right.
So Fiorina had the first oh debate moment. And everybody said, oh, well, let's look at Carly Fiorina. I really hadn't thought about her too much. And this time I think that it was Rubio and Cruz's turn for everyone to go, oh, okay, there are more people up there.
Yeah, that's true, because they didn't have those moments in previous
debates.
Not
earlier.
Where Carly has already set the stage for who she is. So, yeah, you're probably right. What do you think, Laura?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I also think it's going to be interesting to see how this whole party kind of winnows down to, like, you know, a top handful of candidates. Because I do think that at the end of the day, you know, it's going to have some outsiders and some insiders. But if I had to take a bet, I think they're all going to be of the new generation. And by that, I mean that, you know, I don't think Huckabee is going anywhere. I don't think that, you know, even for that matter, we already saw Rick Perry have to leave the stage. I imagine that there's going to be much more interest in kind of those newer, fresher faces than in, say, the Jeb Bushes of the field.
Right, absolutely. And you know, I have to say, to me on that stage, Huckabee was basically pitching that I'm going to be at the senior citizen homes and I'm going to bring you out to vote. I mean, that's just the way it came across. And Kasich, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, and Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, they needed to be happier. You know, people want I know it's sort of a cliche, but they want the happy warrior. And they came across as sort of like, why aren't you paying attention to everything that I'm doing? Why aren't you paying attention to how much I care about certain things about the government and the Constitution and functioning, making the government function better? What do you guys think, Allie?
I think you're right. It's incredible to me that these guys, particularly Kasich, who's been around for so long. I mean,
right.
I remember when he was in the House.
Yep.
You know, he is smart. He is experienced. And you would think that he would know better.
Yeah.
You would think that he would have his arms around the idea that in order to run for president, you do have to seem a little bit cheerful,
right.
You know, a little bit excited about it, you know, and sort of just being the cranky dad who's standing up lecturing
right.
at you about eating your vegetables. That has never gone over well with the American public, and it's never going to.
No. And Laura, what do you think about Rand Paul?
Well, I think Rand Paul is really something of a tragic figure. I mean, he had so much kind of opportunity in this race, and I think, you know, early on when he took a lot of positions, whether it was criminal justice reform, and he was first to talk about why Ferguson, Missouri was really, a sort of long failing of federal policy and state policy and how we needed to rethink these relationships. I mean, I thought that he had a really compelling case for sort of a new kind of conservatism. And yet, as we've seen this election go forward, all he has done is be sort of really frustrated that it seems like Trump stole his thunder to be a new kind of conservative. And he seems upset that people do not take the issues that he takes seriously. And he keeps saying to them, you know, what is wrong with you, essentially, that you don't get how important this is. And that's never going to work. I mean, the purpose of a campaign is to persuade and convince other people that your vision is not only the right vision, but the most important vision to focus on at this moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, opinions are going to, we're all over the place over who won the debate, but it is clear who lost it. The format was bad. The moderation was combative. It was surly. I mean, one of the first things that you learn as a reporter is the debate is never about you. And it is always about the people on the stage. And these hosts, they really gave my profession a very bad name. I was uncomfortable with four people on that stage on Wednesday night. One of them was Jeb Bush. The other three were the moderators. and I don't think that feeling's going to go away. Okay, let's jump to the new Speaker of the House, the 54th Speaker of the House, the youngest speaker since, I think it's 1862. We have Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, former chairman of the Ways and Means. He's now the new Speaker of the House. He takes over a House that has been majority Republican since the first wave election in 2010, became more Republican in 2014. And while people have been saying how split apart this House is, and Laura, I'm going to you with this question, it really is just a fraction of the party that is split away from the whole body, the whole sort of Republican conference. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of factors that are kind of coming together in this. And interestingly enough, I do think Paul Ryan kind of represents, you know, this younger guard and this new generation and kind of the turnover. But he is also somebody who has had government experience. He wants to be a policy wonk. You know, he's the one who's put forward kind of, you know, serious bills, even though they've been attacked, you know, by Democrats. There's no one who could say that he wasn't serious about trying to think about entitlement reform. Mm-hmm. And in addition, when you look at what the House is doing, I mean, on the one hand, it's nowhere near as kind of volatile as it was, say, during the Gilded Age. I mean, during the Gilded Age, we actually changed majority parties six different times in the span of 24 years. In sort of our most modern 24-year period, it's only changed hands three times. So we should say that the volatility and the seat changes are in some ways much more muted than they were in the past. That being said, we do have a Republican Party that is larger than it has been in, you know, 60 years, and it is essentially a party right now that is trying to figure out who it is. And with that comes a lot of people who are new to Washington and also don't seem to understand that Washington is a process. It's not, you know, one action. And there is sort of a long history here, and it does take winning three election cycles in a row for a party to really be able to accomplish its policy aims. So there's, I would say, kind of naivete and impatience. There is kind of this factional dispute that is part of where the Republicans are. And then there are these generational changes. And all of those things, I think, are contributing to something of a raucous House, but not necessarily a historically, you know, broken chamber,
right,
as people make it.
Right. It's always, I love people's reactions, like, oh, this has never happened before. It's never been like this before. That's one of the things Laura and I, Ellie, are constantly just sort of rolling our eyes at, and we'll talk to each other back and forth. Like, now we know this has happened before, and here and there and here and there.
Sure. Now the always happened before, and the polarization, and I agree 100%. I would just argue that the one thing that strikes me is that nothing's getting done.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a historic low number of bills that have been passed into law. And so I agree with you that we do need a couple of election cycles under our belt. But so far, I can't figure out what they want. I know what they don't want. They've been very clear about stopping things. But
right.
I don't know what they do want. And I don't think they know what they want. I know what they don't like.
Right.
I know they want to burn the place down. But since you can't do that and actually still live in your office, you need to do something. And right. So they haven't been really articulate about that yet.
Well, I think part of the problem is, and Lauren, I want you to weigh in here. Part of the problem is 2010 and 2014 were brake pedal elections. They were literally, the message people sent them when they picked them over Democrats was to be the brake pedal to Obama. So they went in there and did that. And unfortunately, when you're always saying, when you're always being the brake pedal, when you're always stopping things or becoming a hurdle, you then grind everything to a halt. And then people turn around and say, well, why don't you do anything? And they're like, well, but you sent us to stop everything. Right. Laura?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, that's absolutely right. But there's also kind of a couple other things. The House actually has passed a lot of bills, but they haven't either been taken up in the Senate or passed through the Senate and therefore haven't made it to the president's desk. So part of the problem is just our process in general. Nobody has kind of large enough coalitions in any elective branch to really do anything except President Obama in the executive branch, where it only sort of involves him, right? The majority mm-hmm. is his decision-making. Mm-hmm. So the Senate and the House have had a serious working difficulty for absolutely, you know, the last 6 years. But I think what you're going to see is kind of more and more coordination, because those who are in the Freedom Caucus have essentially pledged to support Ryan. That is, assuming that Ryan doesn't, I think, go too far toward accommodationist policies with either the Senate or the president. And the one last thing I would say is, what's so amusing to me about this whole situation is that the Freedom Caucus is arguing that they want more deliberation. They want more power in the House. They essentially are frustrated because they feel like party leadership is doing things without them. And quite frankly, we know from studying Congress that the more deliberative a body gets, the less efficient it becomes.
Right.
So
right.
In fact, you know, there is a reality that, yes, the House may become even more deliberative than it's been. It may be more open to some of these Freedom Caucus members. And that also means they're actually going to accomplish less. So how their constituents react to that is, I think, going to be a really interesting question going forward.
All right, ladies. Well, I just want you to give me your scorecard on Boehner. Allie, I'll begin with you.
You know, I think that, and Laura, I want to know if my sense is true, that he left having just made everybody on the hard right in the House really super mad, and that made his day. I mean, my sense was that he went into that bipartisan agreement and fixed a lot of the budgetary stuff, and that just pissed off so many people that he was like, see ya! And he could have a big cake made with the agreement that he forged. That I could be really wrong, but in my life, I like to think of happy things, and that would make me happy. Do you think that's true?
No, Allie, I will tell you, I think you're right. I think to a certain degree, you know, Boehner, if you go back to the July 2011 agreement, Boehner mm-hmm. actually went to extraordinary measures. I mean, even
he
taking
did.
The bill to the floor and letting it fail in order to move that policy more to the right. One mm-hmm. of the things that has happened, you know, in Boehner's tenure is that, you know, the Bush tax cuts were made permanent. The Republicans were able to say, you know, woe to the Democrats' desire to raise taxes on those above $250,000, and the number became $400,000. So some of the policies that the conservatives wanted and said they were fighting for, right, we ended up with sequestration, which mm-hmm. did actually reduce the amount of spending. The deficit, in fact, has shrunk and shrunk substantially, and it's not because we're growing wildly in this country. It is also because spending has not increased in a normal fashion. So I think there was a place where Boehner just got tired of having his conservative credentials questioned by this Freedom Caucus. You know, he mm-hmm. was one of the people who originally revolted, you know, against Newt Gingrich. So mm-hmm. there was a part of him that was just sitting here going, oh, you know, you people are driving me crazy.
Right.
You know, trying to do everything that you want, and you appreciate nothing. And so I do think that at the end of the day, the way he exited and sort of his timing of his decision to leave and the budget deal that he did on the way out the door was all about saying, you know, see, young bucks, you really don't know all that you think you do.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad my sense on that was right.
I think that concludes it perfectly. Allie, thank you so much for joining Laura and I on Off Road Politics. I hope you come back again. This was really, really great. This is like The View,
so
only
fun.
Better. We're nice girls, not mean girls.
Absolutely.
Laura,
thanks
again for being my partner in crime. That's it this week for Off Road Politics. You can follow Laura on Twitter. It's at LARAM Brown, PhD, and Allison, what is your Twitter handle?
It is at Allie Dagnes, which is ALIDAGNES.
Okay, follow the ladies, everyone. That's it this week for Off-Road Politics. Till next week,
Thank
have
you.
A safe weekend. Thanks. Bye-bye,
Thanks.
Girls. Bye.